When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, blenders, and welcome. Welcome to another episode of Real Blend, an interview with Kevin Smith that we are bringing to you guys on its own, separate, because Kevin is a returning guest, deserves a spotlight all to himself, has a new film coming out, and was really happy to come on the Real Blend podcast, join us again to talk about his new film, The 430 Movie. Obviously, we've had Kevin on the show a couple of times over the years. If you haven't had a chance to go back and listen to those previous appearances, he tells what, you know, has to be one of the most legendary stories in Real Blend history, which is him giving our own Kevin McCarthy credit for bringing Ben Affleck back into the View Askew universe in time for the Jay and Silent Bob reboot. We've had Kevin on to talk about a bunch of his different films. Needless to say, Kevin has just been a friend of the show over the years. And so anytime that he has a film coming out, we want to get a chance to have him come on the show, talk about it, talk about the production, putting it all together. He has some really great stories about the making of this one, a very bizarre mix up between George R.R. Martin and a name that I will allow you guys to learn about during the interview. It's kind of a surprise. His new film is called The 430 Movie. It's a throwback to, you know, those sort of coming of age teenage comedies filmed at the Smod Castle Cinemas in New Jersey. So very much a homegrown production for Kevin Smith. And I'm thrilled that he came on Real Blend again to talk about this new film. So here's Kevin Smith returning to the Real Blend podcast on behalf of his new film, The 430 Movie.
And congratulations to you, man. I know I told you earlier what the movie was. It's incredible. So thank you for taking the time to do it for our show.
Oh, my God. No worries. You're so sweet.
There's a lot of great interactions, a lot of great dialogue sequences in this film. Particularly, I love the scene where Austin's talking outside to the, you know, about movies and how they affect our lives. And she says something along the lines of movies make our lives make sense. And I love that line so much. And I was just curious if you could look at different times of your life and different movies that did fill in gaps about your own life for you and like what how that line pertains to you personally.
Oddly enough, the line is movies make life make sense. And I mean, thinking back when I was a kid, oddly at age 11, 12, I saw The World According to Garp, based on the John Irving book. I think this is a George Roy Hill directed motion picture. Robin Williams is in it. Nobody really talks about it anymore, but it's an amazing film that studies an entire life. You spend Garp's life with him over the course of the movie. And the biggest takeaway from that was like, you know, we're all going to die, but the important part is to have an adventure, you know, before you die. Probably this is an R-rated movie, probably way too grown up for where I was in life at that time for being 11 or 12. But my old man took me to see that movie right here. And it was almost like him communicating, like, you can handle this. I mean, there's a scene where a guy gets his dick bit off, you know, in a fucking car. He's getting and the car gets hit and he gets his dick bit off. And my father looked at me. He's like, don't tell your mother about that part. But the fact that he trusted me with that flick, it maybe come down to something as simple as he wanted to see it himself. But the fact that he was like, you can handle this. You know, there's in some media, movies, TV shows, they show like a father-son bonding moment where like the father hands the son a beer and he's like, you know, this is between us or whatever.
Yeah.
That I never had that with my old man, but that was the closest approximate I think I've ever had where he was like, you can handle this. Like, you know, that's honestly how he communicated to me. Most clearly I feel, other than the disciplinary shit of like, be quiet or, you know, do better in school. But he brought me to the movies and shared what moved him. And in the, you know, dark movie theaters where I got to see not my father, but like Don Smith, the guy at the core of my dad, who was, you know, would laugh hysterically at things that taught me what was and what wasn't funny. That would get emotional. I turned over at one point, took me to see Raging Bull, which was like, you know, I was again, like probably 11 at that point. And it's not really a flick you bring a fucking tween to. But he was just like, oh, you'll love it. It's like Rocky. And it's not like Rocky at all. My biggest complaint, I remember, I was like, ugh, it's in black and white, which is really ironic. So I was bored throughout most of the movie. And then at one point I looked over to see my dad because I was going to be like, can I get money for popcorn and go out? And my dad was crying. And it was based on some make pretend shit that was happening on the screen, you know, and that impacts you. My father never once said you could make movies, even though we sat next to each other in movie theaters from the time I was like five until I was making movies myself. But, you know, it was seeing how the art form, the media would even affect somebody like my father, who was kind of like, not certainly not emotionally stilted, but very reserved, very, you know, he didn't wear his heart on his sleeve. He never would have posted pictures of himself crying after seeing Black Panther 2 on the internet. That much I can assure you. He was that type of guy. So seeing that vulnerability, seeing the person at the center of the role that he was, you know, that had an impact. I can draw you a direct line from this theater to what I do today, and particularly to the 4:30 movie.
You know, we were talking about the score. The score is remarkable. Bear did an amazing job. But you've always been really good about juxtaposing score and soundtrack. I mean, I feel like that's a really interesting balance you have to cross as a filmmaker. You look at a lot of films like Tarantino, for example. He'll be heavy soundtrack for Pulp Fiction, and then he'll go Ennio Morricone for Hateful Eight, and you're going all score. But to get the two right is really, I think, really tough. And you always do that. Can you talk about that balance?
You're absolutely sweet, but it's not a talent. It really comes down to resources. So if you have a lot of resources, you do as much needle drop as you want. For example, I went to see Ben's movie Air. I went to the premiere, and it was right around the time we were going to be making the 4:30 movie, both movies set in the 80s. So when I sit down to watch Air at the premiere, other than it's a wonderful flick, if you haven't seen it, Ben killed it. It's utterly, honestly, his most rewatchable movie, I think.
Great.
But the needle drop soundtrack on that movie, they literally play every 80s song there is. Yeah. Sometimes for 5 seconds as a transition to another song. Sometimes a bigger chunk. Honestly, has to be one of the most expensive soundtracks in recent memory of a movie, because all of those songs have their own publishing. They all cost money. So as I watched it, I was like, well, I can't do that. Like, I can't out 80s that. I don't have the budget for that. There's no way on earth I could pull that off. So we budgetarily had room for like 2 affordable songs, which meant that, like, how are you going to sonically fill the rest of the movie? That's where score comes in. So for me, it's never been a question of like, I just know the right balance, kids. It really comes down to, we only have this much money for needle drop, for songs, for the soundtrack. So the composer is going to be handling the lion's share of the underscoring emotive of, you know, pulling the strings to tell the audience how to feel and where we are in the movie and stuff. So it really comes down to that. You know, when I did, Jay and Silent Bob Strike
Back. Is that your most expensive soundtrack, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back?
Probably, of everything.
It's a great soundtrack.
It's not Universal, thank you. And that was Kathy Nelson. She was at Universal. She was the one that was like, here's a stack of music to pull from. And one of those tracks was Afro Man's Because I Got High. But at the same time, as much as I love that soundtrack, when I think of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, it's Jim Venable's score. Jim Venable, who we worked with on Clerks, the cartoon, who we adored from the Powerpuff Girls. He was the guy, dun, 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 dun. And me and Scott were like, that guy, why don't he do a movie? And so we got him to do Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. For 4:30 movie, Bear McCreary and I had just worked together for 2 seasons on Masters of the Universe. And he did the massive Basil Poliadoris type of score on that thing. He read that I was making the 4:30 movie, and he reached out and was like, can I score that? He was like, I've always wanted to do an 80s movie. I think I could really nail it. And he didn't even read the script or anything like that. So when he read the script, I was like, look, Bear, it's honestly one of the most straightforward, simple movies I've ever made. This is the movie I made when I was coming out of the nut house. So it's about as fragile as I was when I came out. There was no edge to it whatsoever. So he was like, I don't know. I feel it. I like it and stuff. And very supportive along the way. He always saw what the movie could be, even when I was just like, I don't know. Nobody says cocksucker. You know, like for me, in order for a movie, for a Kevin Smith movie to be a Kevin Smith movie, there's, you know, some check marks and we were missing some, particularly, you know, just the edge that I tend to lean toward for most of my stuff. But what we lack in edge, we make up for in utter heart. And that seems to be what's communicating to the audience. But Bear has everything to do with that. He's almost like the sixth lead in the movie. Like you've got Austin Major, you've got Nick Cirillo, you've got Reed Northrup, Sienna Aguidong, Ken Jeong, and then Bear McCreary's score is almost its own character in the movie. And Smodcastle Cinemas as Atlantic Cinemas, that's the sixth character. Bear's score would probably be seventh because it really lends heart to the entire movie. It's so big while being entirely intimate. You know, there are these moments where the score soars, just like in life, in a very normal average life or day, you hit moments that are bigger than life. He found a way to capture that, man. I've been driving around the area where we shot the movie out here in Atlantic Highlands. That's where Smodcastle Cinemas is. And it's been on, you know, my Spotify on replay and stuff. And it works as like this unremembered, but suddenly rediscovered soundtrack of my childhood. Like now my memories didn't have compositions in them. If anything, they had songs that were popular in the era. But thanks to Bear's score, which is so penetrating and goes back so deep, it now kind of reclaimed my childhood. When I think back, I hear his music as if that's what was playing when I was a kid. It's stupid, but that's how good it is.
I love that. So one of my favorite scenes that you ever wrote is in Mallrats when Jason Lee encounters Stan Lee, and Stan Lee basically kind of tells him that story to try and push him towards the relationship. That there's a scene in this film where Bernie comes across Major Murder that felt similar in tone, where there was a realization that he's getting from this guy that he thought was someone else. Now, I know it's with Stan Lee, it's kind of more of like he's told to say certain things to Jason Lee's character. But am I overreaching thinking that those scenes are kind of in similar heart?
I could take you through almost every Kevin Smith movie and point to that scene. Clerks, Silent Bob, there's a million fine looking women in the world, dude, but most of them, you know, but they don't all bring you lasagna at work. Most of them cheating. And Dante's like, he's right, I love her. It always takes some outsider to see the situation more clearly than somebody else. And in Mallrats, you've got Stan Lee, which is kind of like an unintentional homage to American Graffiti when Richard Dreyfuss meets Wolfman Jack. Chasing Amy, Jane, Silent Bob come out of nowhere and give our main character like a speech that he kind of misreads. Dogma, there is none of that because we're just dealing in this silly supernatural comic booky type world. Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back. Is there a moment where somebody's like, hey man, I know there isn't Jay and Silent Bob reboot, that's Holden, where Jay and Silent Bob meet with Holden, and it's the reverse of the Chasing Amy scene where they give him the advice. And you know that fucking scene only exists because of you, my friend. So yes, to say the least, the Major Murder scene is very much like the Stan Lee scene. And that to me is like this movie, probably like many movies I make, is coming of age. It's just this time it's appropriate because the kids are fucking 16 as opposed to in their 20s. And everybody's like, they haven't grown up yet and shit. And in order to get there, cinematically speaking, I can't speak to the real world, although it helps. And I have had those moments. But cinematically speaking, I love the story of the person who sets you straight, gives you the information, gives you a different point of view that changes things. Happens twice in the 4:30 movie in back-to-back scenes. Nick Cirillo and Sam Richardson have the scene as Bernie and Major Murder. And then right after that, we've got Austin has the same kind of moment with Austin Zager's character, Brian David, with Genesis Rodriguez's,
which is movies make life make sense. There's the line right there.
Yeah, she fucking crushes it. I love Genesis, man. Like she was in Tusk with us and absolutely brilliant. She was in Yoga Hosers, so I owe her as well. But I've loved being able to work with her, and this happened. Like, she came into this like totally by accident. I was in Atlantic Highlands. We were about a week and a half away from shooting the movie, and I was hiking every morning and stuff, and it was hot humidity of the summer, so it was real hot and went up blazing, so I'm like sweating shit off, and I get a message on my text on my phone from George R.R. Martin, I assume. He's been here to the theater, he did a show here and stuff. So he said, hey, how you doing? And I had just seen an article that he had went out and saw Barbie or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm great, man. I saw Barbie too, and I loved it. And then the person I assumed was George R.R. Martin wrote back like, yeah, I get Barbie was good. I'm going to be in New Jersey this summer. And I was like, oh, great. I said, why don't you come be in the 4:30 movie? It's a new movie I'm making. Like, it's at the theater. So come be in it. And person wrote back, do you know who this is? And I was like, of course. And then I was like, do I? And I looked, and in my phone, George R.R. Martin is G-R-R-M, as he is in most places. But Genesis, like, is listed. She listed herself as G-R. Genesis Rodriguez. So whole time I thought I was talking to George R. R. Martin, I'm talking to Genesis. And I figure this out, and I'm like, of course I know this is you, Jenny. Absolutely. Yes. Come be in the movie. So I had no part for Genesis. And, you know, she was just like, are there lines? And is it what? How many scenes? And I was like, absolutely. I was like, I'll send it to you. So when I got off the text with her, suddenly I was like, oh shit, I got to create a scene for Genesis. And a character, never mind a fucking scene. Like, how do I weave this person into the script when we're like a week and a half ready to week and a half from going? So suddenly I was like, oh, she could be like Boba Fett to like Manager Mike's Darth Vader. She's just always in the background and shit. And then I could give her like a big splashy monologue scene to do. And so honestly, that's my favorite scene in the movie. Me too. I love the movie to death, but that scene, my heart skips a beat. It wouldn't have existed just like that. The Ben Affleck scene in Jay and Silent Bob wouldn't have existed were it not for you and the interview you did with Ben Affleck years ago. That scene wouldn't have existed if I didn't mistake Genesis Rodriguez for George R.R. Martin. And it makes the movie. Like, imagine that movie without that fucking scene, it would work. But like that scene, that's everyone, most people talk about. Like, I saw a picture of a dude online, hadn't even seen the movie yet, got the tattoo, movies make life make sense. I was like, bro, I hope you like the fucking flick. Turns out later on he wrote that he did. So that line, that scene wouldn't have existed, but not for a fucking accident, mistake that turned into a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, I love when she says, you don't think I make $3.05 an hour because I want to be here. It's because movies are my life. And like that is my favorite scene in the whole film as well.
It is about that type of scene, Kev, is that being recognized, or for lack of a better expression, seen by the other, which is in most of my films, some adult, some grown up, right? Hmm. Let's just take the two cases of Mallrats and the 4:30 movie. Kids are similar age. Mallrats are about 18. 4:30 movie, they're like 16 and stuff. The Stan Lee scene is an adult, not just an adult, but an adult who does a thing that person would respect, right? So it's not like, oh, he's an adult, so I'll listen to him. It's like, if he's an adult who, you know, fucking runs the KFC, Brody's not going to give a shit. This is an adult who impacted his life, impacted the culture, Stan Lee. So of course he's going to be listening to him. But it's the fact that there's this magical moment where the other, where the adult sees the discarded, you know, kids generally feel like not seen and stuff like that. And for a moment, they're the focus. And that's where the character finds growth. Same thing in the 4:30 movie. It's like suddenly both characters get this moment to talk to an adult who sees them for who they are and recognizes them in the moment, and they become better people because of it. I don't know where I fucking learned that shit. Like, honestly, I honestly had to be from some other better movie, because most of my movies are, you know, some total of parts of way better movies I saw and I'm trying to approximate, because I don't think that ever happened to me in real life. Like, I never met some famous fucker who put me on the right path or something like that. But the poignancy of Major Murder in the 430 movie, at least to me personally, is naturally he's modeled on Sergeant Slaughter, because his 80s reference, 80s wrestling reference. Sergeant Slaughter, that's in the movie because he lived near us. And growing up, that captured my imagination. Even though I wasn't like a wrestling fan, I was like, Sergeant Slaughter lived, somebody famous lives here, lives between Atlantic Highlands and Highlands? This is nuts. So I'd written it originally for Sergeant Slaughter, but then I hit him up at a con. And I was like, it's a big scene. You got a lot of dialogue. He's like, I'm not an actor. And I was like, good to know. Thank you. So I was able to pivot, make it Major Murder, and bring in Sam, who I absolutely love.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
One of the things that, like, a lot of the film for me felt like a comfort, it felt like a blanket, like a warm blanket. But because it all, and I was born in 84, so my time period of all the sneaking into films was the 90s, but this still spoke to me in such a way. But the thing that it really reminded me of is how much I miss watching a trailer in a theater and not having it available online. And one of the characters says, I hope we get The Fly. And I remember being a kid going, I hope we get this Jurassic Park trailer. I hope we get that trailer, because you had to go to the theater to learn that a new movie was coming out, like, or see a poster. So I was just curious what pivotal trailers were important to you, like the ones that you would hope would show up at your theaters and during your movies. Like, what were trailers that had an impression on you when you were younger?
When I was a kid, so we're talking... let me see, 19, I want to say 79. What was Empire Strikes Back? 80?
So 80. I think
in 79, there was a Star Wars re-release late in the year that featured a trailer for The Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, nowadays, naturally, everybody consumes the trailer online and whatnot. And in the 80s, 90s, even in the aughts, the power of one very important trailer could drive an audience to just go pay for that movie to see the trailer. Case in point, Battlefield Earth, I think, enjoyed a box office bump because it had the Phantom Menace trailer.
Right.
My dates match up. So I remember begging my parents, and repeat seeing movies in a theater was something we just didn't do. We were lower middle class. So seeing it once, that was it, you know. And then hopefully later on you'd see it when it came to TV, and then, you know, cable was invented and VCR, and suddenly the window was getting closer and closer. But even back then, it was like a good year before you can have it on VHS or something like that. So I remember begging my parents, please, like, can we just go see Star Wars again? And they're like, you saw it. And I was like, I know, but they're showing the trailer, or what we called back then, the sneak preview for Empire Strikes Back. They took me to this very cinema to see Star Wars again. Two of the most bitter motherfuckers who are like, I can't believe we're seeing a movie again. Like, they did not see the future, where it's like, kids, all we do is rewatch the movies we love. That's our comfort blanket and shit. So trailer has always been part of the ceremony in my life. You know, when I was a kid, it's like, we got to get there ahead of time, not for the snacks, but so we're in our seats when the trailers begin. This is the only way we could get them. Do you remember the magic of going to the movies on a Thursday? Well, fuck Thursday. That never even happened in childhood. On a Friday night.
Oh.
And going like, I wonder what trailer we're going to get. And like, it was like going to a casino. It was the closest feeling I've ever had, waiting to see which trailer is going to pop, watching numbers fall at a casino, hoping it's going to fall your way, man. And then like, oh, it's the trailer for Aliens. This is amazing. You know,
yeah.
It's... those days are gone now. It's not like, and everything sucks now. Not at all. Now we have the convenience of like, hey man, I'm going to open my phone and I'm going to watch the brand new trailer that they dropped, the third trailer that they dropped for this movie I'm looking forward to. And so there's a satisfaction and gratification in that. Absolutely. But as people tell you, as old people used to tell me when I was a kid, and naturally I was like, fucking senior citizen. You know, we say it in the movie, have fun, don't run. Yeah. You got to slow it down, man. Like the problem with kids is I'm no longer one, always in such a hurry to get to like where we are as adults. And then you get to this place where you have experience and wisdom and you just want to warn the future, like stay where you are, enjoy, like don't get engaged in this nonsense, man. Because once it begins, life begins in a different way and you leave all that behind. And it's important for me at least to hold on to that, a bridge to that. And making a 4:30 movie, you want to talk about a bridge to adolescence, like in my hometown, in the theater that I own with my friends, but the theater we grew up going to and whatnot, being able to showcase like the world this character was from, and this character is real close to me and whatnot, was easy. I saw somebody online was like, I wish I could remember the 80s as vividly as you. He's like, you remembered moments and feelings that I had and stuff. And I think that's because I never quite left them behind. I never leave anything behind. You know, for a lot of people, it's like Clerks happened 30 years ago. For me, it happened yesterday. These things stay vital in my world. I still discuss them on an almost daily basis with fans or online or around business and stuff. But the same with my life growing up in Highlands, like in Jersey in the 70s and 80s. I never really left that behind. So this is the furthest I've reached back in my art to be like, this is what life was like back then. Most of the stuff I've done kind of represented life from the 90s forward. And I realized while making this movie, it's probably because I wasn't like smoking weed, the clarity that I had of what my job is while I was sitting on set, so fucking dialed in like this. You know, normally I'm just like, hey man, we're having a good time, right? Like host mode and shit. But on the 4:30 movie, like I spent most of the time standing or on Apple boxes, staring at the monitor. And I didn't give much direction, which is probably why the movie's really good. Like, you know, by the time you work with actors of this caliber, I don't care how old or young they're all Jedi. So they're going to get it right. So there's nothing I could go in there and say that's going to, you know, make it better. Other than like, can we do it faster or do it again? But you said this word wrong or something like that. But as I was sitting there, I realized what my job is, particularly on this movie. And I wonder if it is going forward as well. Like I try to approximate a memory or a feeling synthetically, artificially, and then pass it on. Something happened to me. Wonderful moment, passing moment, a feeling that came from that moment. So I spend most of my time trying to figure out, like, it was so impactful for me and so meaningful, you want to share it, but you don't want to share it as yours because ultimately people are like, well, fucking good for you. You got to dress it up in something that they can see themselves in as well. So basically I sit on a set and artificially recapture moments that were authentic, that were so powerful and so moving to me that I'm like, let me see if I can get that right. And it's always a pale imitation of the real thing. But if I do my job correctly, that feeling communicates, you know, and somebody's like, oh, I get it. And it reminds me of like when I was a kid in Mad Magazine, they had a comic. It was around the time Jaws was out in theaters. And I think it was Sergio Aragones who did it. It was a bunch of people underwater in scuba tanks and masks, and they were shooting a fake shark, an obviously fake shark that was hung from wires from a boat above, cameras and lights all over it and stuff, like all this deal into capturing this moment. And then just on the outskirts are like six sharks staring at it. Like, and that's, while I was making this, that's kind of, I had this out of body experience where I was like, oh my God, I'm literally just trying to recapture the past and then present it to others and be like, do you get it? Do you feel the way I did? And then it's theirs. It's the audience's for the rest of my life. And periodically then I'll interact with the movies for the rest of my life, bump into that moment and be like, oh shit. Like I remember when that was mine. Now it belongs to everybody else. And you know, that moment is going to be, or as I've heard so far on social media. And I know based on the previous body of work going forward, that moment will impact somebody to the point where somewhere down the road, they're going to tell me that, like, that's the movie I watched that saved my life, and tell me some wonderful, gripping story about how some goofy ass art I made made a difference in their life. That's not why I started the journey. I started the journey selfishly to be like, I just want to tell stories. I want to make movies. But 30 years in, you find different reasons why the journey means so much. And knowing, like, that whatever you're working on, and I know this for a fact, doesn't matter what the fuck it is, even if it's yoga hosers, it echoes through time. Somebody will tell you some amazing story about fucking how yoga hosers affected them and stuff. So I know this movie, which is made on pure feeling, pure heart, you know, there's nothing going on in this movie plot wise. It's I think I was trying to get as close to Pretty in Pink as possible. You know, when I was, it's clearly I'm going for John Hughes, but the idea where the smallest thing in the world is the biggest thing in your universe. Yes. Will they wind up going on this date? Will my friends like her? You know, all these questions that, like, you know, I haven't had for fucking years, but I remember shaped who I was when I was a kid and left such an impression that I was able to reach back fairly easily and pull it into the present, reshape it and be like, look.
What you just said is the feeling that I had when Brian calls Melody and asks her on the date. And on the call, he says, hold on. And he, like, starts doing this, like, dance, like in his, like, you know, before, like, and he goes, oh, I'm back. Yes. That reminded me so much of calling girls to ask them out. Do you have a memory of that? Like, of calling somebody to ask them out? Is it similar to that moment?
You literally watched it. It is that. That's it. Opening scene of the movie, like, happened here in this town. There's a Chinese food restaurant down the street now. It's New Beijing, but back then it was China Taste. And Kim Loughran, who's now Kim Garvey, was working there. And I was living in Highlands at my house. And I called her that one day and made this ridiculous order. And then ended it with, like, 6.5 almond cookies and your hand in marriage. Like, so, you know, it was one of those goofy ass things that, like, the older one gets, the more you're like, oh, I cringe. But it's authentic. Like, it's real. And in this flick, I was trying to make something as real as I could, try to capture a moment in time, capture a feeling more than anything else. And I owe all that. This is crazy, but I owe all that to Paul Thomas Anderson. It was when the first time I started thinking about this movie is when I saw Licorice Pizza. I was like, oh my God, what if, I mean, honestly, a double feature of Licorice. I know, like, it looks like this looks as perverse as I mean it, but a double feature of Licorice Pizza and 4:30 movie would tell you two things. One, Paul Thomas Anderson is a much better filmmaker. And two, we are apparently at that stage of life where we're both kind of looking back. But I remember seeing that flick and being like, oh shit, man. Like, I want to do that. I want to do my version of that. So, yes, it has a lot to do with him, but really everything to do with Kim Loughran and that phone call, like, from years and years ago, from way back in May 25th,
1986. Wow. Last thing I'll ask you is this. What are the most movies you've seen in one day? Like, what is your epic sneak in from movie to movie?
I'm trying to remember. When I was a kid, 5, I think, was the max, right? Because if you got dropped off at 2... that's 10 hours of programming, and that takes you to shutdown. So yeah. I don't think we could push any more than 5. So that'd be 5. But I know the movie I saw the most in a movie theater, and I only paid for it once, and I didn't pay for it. My father did. The rest of the times I saw it for free by jumping theaters, paying to see something else, and then just spending the day at the theater. Raiders of the Lost Ark, 82 times in a theater.
82 times.
Fucking year, man. Like, those were the days where it's like movies didn't come and go quickly. That just stayed in theaters. And so I remember it
played. That was your Astro Blaster.
Very much so.
And if Ass Blaster.
If you could have referenced Raiders of the Lost Ark and not gotten sued, I would have.
Well, congratulations to you, man. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. The movie's absolutely amazing. And everything I've said, I genuinely mean. I think people need to. The Licorice Pizza thing now makes so much freaking sense. Right? They should strike.
Suddenly you're like, you viewed through this prism. You're like, oh, he's trying to do his own Licorice Pizza. God bless him. And it's a shit pizza, but whatever.
And Harley crushed it as the nun.
She really delivered, man.
The basketball made me laugh so much. It's so good.
Nugget, man, that means the world to me. You know, your opinion I value very highly. And again, I said it before, I'll say it again. You've helped make my art better. You know, I know that for a fact. So I appreciate you.
I appreciate you. It's all cyclical, man. I mean, I'm not the movie fan I am without seeing your films growing up. You are one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. So it's an honor to always chat with you. It's an honor to know you. Everyone go see this movie. It's absolutely incredible. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, man.
It's a pleasure, man.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We want to thank both of the Kevins, obviously Kevin Smith for coming on the show, and our own Kevin McCarthy for handling the interview. The reason why I wasn't able to participate in this one, if you guys have been following along on my social media, I was at a top secret location. I can say that I was in London. I can share that much. And if you tune back in roughly a year from now, I might be able to share with you the full details of what I was able to see on this work trip. So more to come on that. I promise you it'll be something really fantastic that you're going to want to hear. Here's additional fantastic news. Full show on Friday. And guess who's going to be our guest? This is almost too bizarre to say out loud. Francis Ford Coppola is going to join the list of celebrated Real Blend guests. Francis Ford Coppola coming on the show to discuss his film Megalopolis, but not just Megalopolis, his career in general, some of the highlights of some of the most important films in cinema history, and that's not an exaggeration. So you are not going to want to miss that episode. Make sure you tune in on Friday. If you're on our YouTube channel, we appreciate you guys stopping by. Hit subscribe, turn on your notifications. You will be told as soon as the new show drops at 7:30 a.m. Eastern time on Friday mornings. If you're listening to us where you get your audio podcast needs met, we appreciate the support. Continue to follow the show. We'll keep bringing you great episodes, fun interviews like this, and all the best Real Blend content that you guys have come to expect. We'll talk to you guys soon. Night, bitch.